This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 142. Today we speak about Van Til, Barth, and liberalism. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey, and I'm very pleased to welcome to the program Jim Cassidy, who is pastor of Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey. Good afternoon, Jim.
How you doing, Camden?
Doing great. I'm very excited to have you on the program. It's good to talk to you. This is episode number 142, and we're very excited today to be speaking about one of our favorites, Cornelius Van Til. But we will be looking at him and his interaction with the theology of Karl Barth. Jim has a forthcoming article. We won't say where it's forthcoming, but it is forthcoming on the subject, and we're going to be speaking about that subject today. But before we do so, we have a few bits of news to mention. I first want to mention that we are broadcasting live to Machen's Warrior Children around the world at reformedforum.tv, and we are also broadcasting to our iPhone application and our internet radio station. But if you want more information about our live streaming, just visit reformedforum.tv, and all of that is on the main page. In addition, we have a couple conferences coming up. The one I would like to mention is the Bolton Conference, which has been meeting annually since 1985, and it has had many great speakers, including J.I. Packer, D.I. Carson, D.A. Carson, and Sinclair Ferguson. And they have a new conference coming up here this next month, October 22nd and 23rd. And the schedule and other information can be obtained at boltonconference.org. That's the Bolton Conference, October 22 and 23, boltonconference.org. Now, Jim, we have another conference to mention, one that you just spoke about on the Reformed Media Review.
Yeah, that's right. I'd like to encourage our listeners to check out the Princeton Regional Conference on Reformed Theology coming up in November. It's going to be November 5th and 6th, and it's going to be held at Miller Chapel at Princeton Theological Seminary in Princeton, New Jersey. The title of the conference this year is really quite exciting, especially for those of us who are convinced that all of Scripture speaks of and points to the Lord Jesus Christ. And The title of the conference is These Speak of Me, The Glory of Christ in All of Scripture. The two speakers will be David Helm and Kent Hughes. And if you want more information about the upcoming conference, go to AllianceNet.org.
AllianceNet.org. Great. The Princeton Regional Conference in Reformed Theology. Looking forward to that. And if you'd like to hear more about that conference, we devoted an entire episode of the Reformed Media Review to the subject. Just visit reformedforum.org/RMR for information about that conference. Now, of course, this episode, as well as all of our programs on Reformed Forum, is brought to you by our listeners. It is listener-supported, and we thank you so much for your support of Reformed Forum and ask that if you have found benefit and if you've been edified by what we do here, that you would visit reformedforum.org/donate and consider helping us out financially. We, of course, covet your prayers and ask that you would continue to support this ministry in your prayers. But also, if you are able and willing, please visit reformedforum.org/donate. And you can contribute financially and help us with our costs. And they are increasing as our growth continues to progress. The streaming costs and the distribution costs increase, and we can always use your support in helping us to distribute these resources free of charge. We are also pleased to mention reformationart.com. We have a little deal. Andrew Moody, our good friend, who is the proprietor of that website, is going to be sending us some prints, so our video production looks better. We have something on the walls. And in exchange, we'd like to mention his website, reformationart.com. It has plenty of prints and other artwork dealing with Reformation events and Reformed theologians of times past. So if you are looking for something to put on your office wall or in your home or in your church, reformationart.com is a great place to go. Visit that soon. And we thank Andrew Moody and Reformation Art .com for their support of Christ the Center. All right, Jim. Well, it's time to get into our episode today, our actual subject matter. And of course, anybody who's listened to any episode of Christ the Center or all the other episodes that are produced in Reformed Forum is going to know that we're all Vantillians. We love the theology of Cornelius Van Til. Many of us being students or having been students at Westminster Theological Seminary, he is a figure near and dear to our hearts. And as well as many of us being involved with and members and even ministers of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, a church of which Cornelius Van Til was a member, minister of for so many years. And another huge figure in Reformed theology, if we use that in a broad sense, we don't want Machen's Warrior children to have the hair on their necks bristle too much, but that is the figure Karl Barth. And these two have quite a history, at least an intellectual history. Jim, do you want to introduce the subject of Van Til and Barth and how this interaction, at least from Van Til toward Barth, began?
Sure. Happy to do so. Speaking of Machen's Warrior children, it's no coincidence we're talking about Cornelius Van Til this afternoon. And I have an opportunity here to share with you just some thoughts on this. I, by the way, subscribe to Machen's Warrior Children monthly magazine. So I'm a proud member of that association. By
it's
the
not
grace
published
of God.
By the same people who do the Nicotine Theological Journal, is it?
No, I'm just kidding.
We love these facetious titles.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but, that was a title for those who might not be familiar. If you'd like to read an article by John Frame, he has an article. I believe the title of it's Machen's Warrior Children or something to that effect. But
correct.
John Frame correct. Used it in more of a not entirely derogatory, but it wasn't in the greatest of light. But some of us who are a little more on the militant side have taken that title and embraced it.
and made it our own. Kind of like how,
it's like, thank you very much for a label.
Yeah, that's right. You know, just kind of like how we as Americans gladly took the derogatory term Yankees to ourselves, you know, during the Revolutionary War. But anyway, Cornelius Van Til, as you know, Camden, had a long history here interacting in many ways with Karl Barth's theology.
Yeah.
Most of the interaction, as you know, had gone one way. I'm not sure that Barth ever read Van Til's critiques, although there is some indication, as some have hypothesized, that in one of the prefaces to the Church Dogmatics, Karl Barth made a reference to Van Til. If it was a reference to Van Til, it was cloaked and it was hidden. Mm-hmm. So we don't know for sure how extensively well-known Van Til was to Karl Barth. Although there is indication that when they did meet briefly at one time, that Karl Barth said something to the effect of, you know, you're the guy who's been criticizing my theology, and
right.
And Van Til had a very gracious response apparently. But anyhow, so most of the interaction did go one way. Van Til was one of the earliest American critics of not only Barth's theology, but that movement that has been called Neo-Orthodoxy.
Mm-hmm.
As a whole has also been criticized by Van Til. So
part of the reason he became so influential there is because many of the works had not been translated yet. So many people got Barth at that time period through Van Til, if I'm correct, because he was reading it in the German and then writing in English.
That's right. That's right. Van Til was one of the few early American theologians who did not only read German, but read it well and was able to write in English. Maybe we might not say that Van Til wrote good English, but wrote English
wrote
well.
English well. I like that.
but that's give you an idea that at least he was doing it. He was publishing extensively on Karl Barth. Barth's theology, etc. So he was one of the early critics. Now, Some of the, you may be familiar, Camden, with some of the more recent interaction as Van Til, as excuse me, as Barth has become an interest has renewed in Karl Barth's theology,
right.
And it's again once more at front and center of theological studies and all sorts of other studies, but there's a great interest now once again in Barth's theology, and in fact it seems to be somewhat of a staple. If you're an evangelical or you consider yourself evangelical in just even in the broadest sense of the word, and you interact at all with Van Til's critique of Barth, it's almost as if you need to criticize Van Til in order to, you know, be considered cool and reasonable and a reasonable person. In
almost
fact,
a rite of passage.
Almost a rite of passage that you, yeah, exactly, that you critique Van Til's critique of Barth. And some of these words have come up here, Camden, that are interesting. Van Til's critique has been called absurd, inept analysis. Some have said that he wielded a disproportionate influence among evangelicals, tendentious reading of church dogmatics. But one of the criticisms, I think, of Van Til's critique has come from other quarters, and that has been argued that Van Til was motivated by an institutional justification. In other words, it turns out that at Princeton Seminary didn't really go liberal after Machen and the group left, and so but Barthians were coming on the scene, and so what Van Til was motivated by was to give a continual justification for Westminster's existence over against Princeton. Now, part of the problem with that interpretation is that Van Til began his attack on Barthian theology as early as 1931. After 1929, when Westminster, the guys left Princeton and started Westminster, actually Princeton, in terms of the faculty, remained really conservative. Still on the faculty were Gerhardus Voss, William Park Armstrong, who was one of Machen's favorite professors. Caspar Wister Hodge was still teaching there. It's not until 1936 that John A. Mackay comes on as the president of the seminary. And Mackay was no liberal. He was, in fact, he was an anti-modernist. But he was a anti-modernist of the neo-orthodox stripe. He called Barth the great new neo-Calvinist or the great neo-Calvinist.
And that's why so many people have looked to Barth as sort of a hero, because they found a common enemy.
Exactly.
In liberalism.
And that's right. And Mackay was along those lines. He was in no ways a what we might call a fundamentalist. That's, you know, the problematic term, but without going into that. He's not a fundamentalist after the sort of J. Gresham Machen. Mackay is very much neo-Orthodox, but was against liberalism. And then the year after Mackay gets there, Camden, 1937, Emil Brunner comes on for a year to be a visiting professor. And even though Brunner and Barth had their differences, Brunner is fundamentally a Barthian. He's of this neo-Orthodox stripe in 1937. And so what's important for us to highlight, if 1936 is the dividing line when the institution of Princeton really begins to go down a clear Barthian path, 1931 is when Van Til begins his critique of Barth. So his motivations, I argue in my paper, are not institutional. They're theological. Van Til is concerned theologically, apologetically, ecclesiologically for this movement that is arising in place of liberalism. And then the paper tries to answer the critiques that Van Til's interpretation of Barth was inept. And what I like to try to do is in the paper, give some, and here today, perhaps give some thoughts, entering into perhaps the area of Barth's theology which is most well known, namely his Christology, and show how Van Til, or at least give some thoughts. I can't go through all my thoughts here today, but at least begin to give some ideas to what Van Til, how Van Til read Barth's theology as he did through the lens of Christology, and so how Van Til critiques Barth's Christology, and how that is in fact a critique of Barth's theology as a whole, and then show how that this approach to Barth's theology and his Christology is actually an approach which is not only alive and well today among Barthians, men who have never really even read Van Til or could care less about Van Til. But what's interesting is that there are current trends in Barthian scholarship that are supporting Van Til's critique, somewhat in a
– vindicating him almost.
Yeah. Vindicating his read, you know, in a way that is very reminiscent of – I don't want to criminalize anybody, but so take my analogy with a grain of salt. But, you know, in the Gospel of John when, you know, Caesar Pontius Pilate does things and says things which are true, but he says them unwittingly. Like, you know, when he writes, you know, King of the Jews over the cross of Christ, you know, and he's speaking mockery. But even though he's unwittingly speaking the truth, and I think we have a similar – example here of men who are not Pontius Pilate, but I'm not saying that, but who are unwittingly supporting the one that they criticize, namely Cornelius Van Til. So anyway, that's kind of what my paper's about as I develop these things. And one of the things that needs to be kept in mind really fundamentally is that Van Til's critique of Barth's Christology concludes that Barth's Christology is fundamentally Eutychian in nature. In other words, it confuses the divine and the human natures. A very provocative quote here. Van Til is, and this comes from his article called "The Karl Barth Theology," and in this. In this particular article, or in this line, or in this section, Van Til is comparing modernism, liberalism, with Barth's theology. And what Van Til is saying is that there's, at its core, there really is no difference between liberalism and neo-orthodoxy.
And this is Van Til's thoughts on the subject are evidenced in the titles of his two books on the subject, The New Modernism.
Right.
And Christianity and Barthianism, which is directly a play on Machen's Christianity and Liberalism. So he's making statements, even in how he titles his books, that he doesn't think there's a fundamental difference between neo-orthodoxy and liberalism.
That's right, exactly. And what's interesting is, well, let me read this quote to you.
Sure.
And this is what Van Til says about this confusion of the creator-creature distinction in Barth's Christology. By doing this, God is no longer qualitatively distinct from man. Modern theology holds that both God and man are temporal. Barth holds that both God and man are eternal. So if we think about the shift, and there is a shift, there's no doubt there is a theological shift in the theological landscape of the time as we move from liberalism to neo-orthodoxy or Barthianism, and it's a move from immanence theology to transcendence theology. Okay, Barth is very concerned about moving God, as it were, out of the realm of the subject, out of the realm of history, out of the realm of the created order, as it were, and giving God his freedom, making him, as it were, a transcendent, so that the things that we are wrapped up with now don't actually make God who he is. And what he has in view here actually is the whole thing that's going on in Germany, especially with the First Great World War and et cetera, and this idea of confusing Christianity with German nationality. And that is something which is subscribed by his liberal professors. And they support the war. They support this entire German Christian movement. And Barth is coming along and he's saying, no, this isn't good. We can't be, you know, killing people and going to war, you know, in the name of Christ. And so he wants to move Christianity and theology out of the realm of the state and the earth and, you know, things of that nature, things of this present age. And he moves it all completely into the transcendent realm. But the one thing that stays is the dialectical nature of theology. So Barth is known as a dialectical theologian, but dialectical theology did not begin with Karl Barth. Yeah, I mean, it's there, of course, in liberalism, and it goes back to Kant, okay, or at least to Kant, all right? This idea that there are two realms, two worlds that are fundamentally opposed to one another. Kant called it the noumenal realm and the phenomenal realm, okay? And that these two realms, the phenomenal realm being the stuff that we can see and touch and experience, right, et cetera. And then you've got the noumenal realm where we can't touch or experience those things, and that's where you place God, okay? God, it cannot be known, he cannot be experienced, and there can be no convergence between the noumenal and the phenomenal realm. Barth actually carries that presupposition forward into his theology. So now he's got a problem. If we have, and he's addressing the problem of Christian theology, which stems from Christology. How do we understand the two natures in the one person? And these two natures being so fundamentally opposed really can't come together into one nature or into one person. So Barth is concerned to explain this in a way that is reasonable and rational. Okay, and what he does is he tries to explain it by way of dialectic, that these two things, the divinity, the divine nature, and the human nature, stand in a dialectical relationship with one another. And this is important. Mm-hmm. They do not stand within a metaphysical or an ontological relationship to one another, because that would be bad. They can't, because they would be two fundamentally opposed ontological realities that cannot in any way have connection together with one another. So at the very nature of Barth's theology and his entire scheme is that it's anti-metaphysical.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
He wants nothing to do with that old metaphysical approach where we talk about substances and we talk about natures, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this is something, Camden, that Van Til brought out very clearly in the New Modernism. He says this. Let me begin. It's a lengthy quote, but I think that it's important for us to read. To be sure, Barth has repeatedly asserted his desire to construct his theology in total independence of all philosophical schools. Yet, he has also admitted that in his earlier writings, he has been influenced by modern epistemology. This epistemology, which Barth was nurtured in, was controlled by a modern form of critical philosophy, or the critical philosophy of Immanuel Kant. The theology of crisis, in the case of both Barth and Brunner, is essentially a modern theology. By an essentially modern theology, we mean a theology which, like modern critical and dialectical philosophy, seeks to be activistic and anti-metaphysical at all costs. Mm. Now, this is what's very interesting. After Van Til, Van Til writes this to New Modernism, publishes it in 1946, okay? Bruce McCormick, professor at Princeton Seminary, brilliant theologian.
Well-known
Barthian. Mm-hmm. Well-known Barthian, brilliant interpreter of Barth, says this in his book Orthodox and Modern, which is his recent book on Barth's theology. It's a collection of essays. In the introduction, McCormick says this, okay, and he shows no indication of having read Van Til or depending on Van Til's insights. But this is – now, you heard the quote from Van Til. Listen to McCormick. He says this. The fact that Barth devoted so many pages of his writings to criticizing neo-Protestant theology – neo-Protestant, another word for liberal theology – tended to conceal the extent to which his anti-metaphysical stance was itself a distinctly modern option in theology. My own contribution to the European discussion of Barth's relation to modernity was to demonstrate the extent to which Kant – and the later Marburg neo-Kantianism influenced not only his earliest liberal theology, but also decisively stamped his dialectical theology.
Mm.
That's Bruce McCormick. And you take those two paragraphs, you put them right next – you take that paragraph, put it next to Van Til. They're saying the exact same thing about Barth, that Barth's theology is essentially modernistic, it is Kantian, it is anti-metaphysical, actualistic, and any other adjective you want to throw in there. One last quotation, this time from the Kant scholar John Hare, who teaches up at Yale. It's a very just a brief quote, but he, you know, Hare actually recognizes significant discontinuities between Barth and Kant, perhaps more discontinuities than McCormick would allow for. But he argues, though, that, and I quote, that Barth's reliance on Kant was constant. Okay, so there is this modern, if I could put it this way, to rip the expression off from another scholar, but there is this modern impulse that beats through all of Barth's theology, and Barth is not, he doesn't apologize for it. It's there. And while he moves from the immanent to the transcendent, what he does in that move is he takes this dialectical relationship between the humanity and the divinity of Christ, and he brings that confusion, or that actually it's an identity. It's a dialectical identity of the two concepts, the two ideas, because he won't use nature or that type of expression. They're really ideas or concepts. And he moves them out of the realm of the subjective, out of the realm of the liberal immanent position, immanence position, and he moves it into the transcendent. So what you have is Christianity is Jesus Christ, who is eternally God and man, fully God and fully man from all of eternity. Okay, mm-hmm. So what he has done is he has rightly given God his eternal transcendent position. But what he has done also with doing that is he has eternalized the human flesh of Christ as well. So there, humanity and divinity become equally ultimate concepts that exist within a dialectical relationship from all of eternity.
Yeah, it's a major problem.
Yeah. Just a little bit.
It's interesting to hear the dialectical tension between these things, because you find a similar thread as you and I have talked about before with Karl Rahner, except you find almost the opposite direction. It seems as though God is brought down to the level of mankind in Karl Rahner. You have the two divides. I don't know how much Rahner's working directly within the Kantian framework, but he is working within a Hegelian one. And so you find that dialectical tension in which their history is moving towards a synthesis between the thesis, which would be God, the divinity, and the antithesis, which would be humanity. And what we find in Jesus Christ in the hypostatic union, the union of the divine and human in the person of the person of the Son, you find a guarantee there of what will happen for all of humanity, at least for all those who have made a fundamental option for God. So you find similar threads, but it works itself out very differently. Although you still find many of the same philosophical tendencies between a Barth and a Karl Rahner.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And now even Barth, there's a famous quotation that gets batted around here that Barth at one time said that he's fond of doing some Hegeling on occasion.
Hegeling.
Yeah, he turned it into a verb, you know, which is brilliant, you know.
Yeah.
But he does do, you know, some interesting things that does sound very Hegelian. But, you know, it's kind of like, you know, when you talk Hegel, Kant is always right there in the background. I mean, that established presupposition of having these two fundamentally opposed and opposite entities or realities, namely the noumenal and the phenomenal. Once you adopt that as a presupposition, which Barth carries over from his liberal days, you are then automatically in a position where you have to begin developing dichotomies in your thinking, and then you need to solve those dichotomies. And the way in which Barth tries to solve those dichotomies is basically is dialectic, is bringing these things into a – these two opposite things, bringing them into a dialectical relationship to one another so that the one actually means and is the other. There's an interesting – I'll give you an example of what I mean because that could sound awfully abstract. But Van Til has this wonderful quotation, and as I'm looking for it now, I'm just not finding it. Oh, here it is. Here we go. Bart says that in Jesus Christ, God is both wholly like and wholly unlike man. There's the dialectical relation. Herein lies the foundation of the reconciliation of the world with God. He can become truly man and as such the only true man only if he is free to relinquish his being as it is in itself and to become wholly one with man. It is therefore God's nature to become wholly other than himself. This is a classic way in which Van Til articulates Bart's theology, and I think he's spot on. God's nature becomes wholly other than himself. Okay, so not only then for Bart, not only is Jesus Christ God, but God is Jesus Christ. Hmm. Do you see how an Orthodox position cannot hold that latter formulation?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because the fullness of the divine being, the divine essence, it cannot be embodied within Christ, because what Christ does is it is one person of the Trinity, namely the eternal Son, who takes upon himself in time human flesh.
In time.
In time. It's not the Trinity that does that. Okay.
Right.
It is one person of the Trinity.
You always find this though when you start to mess with the creator creature distinction and start to goof with these German philosophical categories, you end up with problems in your theology proper, in your doctrine of the Trinity. You find that also in Rahner too. You find in a lot of these guys that it's going to necessarily work itself out there, but you're exactly right, Jim. The Father did not take on human flesh.
That's right. That's right. On Orthodox grounds, right? Now, of course, the problem is for Bart is that he denies the extra Calvinisticum, right? Mm. So this idea that the infinite cannot be contained within the finite is a notion that gets ran roughshod over by Bart, because in fact it is the fullness of humanity and the fullness of divinity. The entire triune God, in fact, is in this eternal dialectical relationship with humanity, and not just the person of Jesus of Nazareth. In other words, the incarnation is not something that happens in time, in history, in real world calendar events, but it is, again, something that happens in an eternal act, an eternal event of God's making a decision for us in Jesus Christ. And this is where the whole doctrine of election gets recast by Karl Barth as well, is that the doctrine of election is understood as an event. In fact, Jesus Christ is that event of election where God decides for us. But all of this happens kind of in this ethereal, idealistic, or this realm of ideas, in the transcendent realm, in the noumenal realm somewhere.
Exactly.
We don't really have access to it. He's dealing with ideas and concepts, and historical realities are really a secondary consideration, if any at all, for Bart's theology.
Mm. Now, a couple things here, but I want to ask you about some books we might read on the subject. But before we do that, why study Bart now? We understand that there's a resurgence of it, but what significance does Bart or Van Til's criticisms of Bart have for people that are actually in conservative churches? Is there a reason to study and to understand?
Yeah, I think that, you know, anytime you're going to respond to something or say no, nine. To something,
apropos.
to something or someone's theological formulations, you have to hear them out first. And if you can't give an intelligent and informed response to that person's theology and back up your rejection of their theology with actual facts of what their theology teaches, then you ought not to say anything at all, really, because it's just not helpful to do that. So, and one of the things that Van Til did, and here, you know, I'm following distinctly the method of Van Til, where he got what he called, you know, the great white elephant, you know,
the
KD, yeah.
We just saw those down in the his copies of the Church Dogmatics are available, or they're actually down in the Westminster Archive. So I was just on a tour about 2 weeks ago, so I got to see them, see all of his notes, and these things are thoroughly destroyed. He used them so much, they're falling apart.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, one thing you can't say about Van Til was that he didn't understand the man, you know? I mean, Van Til very much tried to understand, I would argue, and I argue in this article, that he did understand Barth. And to boot, some of the great Barthian expositors today are vindicating Van Til's read. Now, you know, to be fair, to be honest and to be fair, this is a huge debate right now among Barthian scholars as far as how to understand Barth. And these interpreters that I have cited, people like McCormick and another guy, Matthias Gockel, and as well as John Hare, you know, these guys have not gone unanswered. I mean, you know, there is a strong voice within the Barthian camp to say, no, McCormick, you're wrong on your reading of Barth, and this is why.
Yeah.
And so one thing to bear in mind, and that we do need to keep in mind here, is that there is another interpretation. But one thing that at least we can say, I think, is that given the similarities between Barth's interpretation, Van Til's interpretation of Barth, and call it the McCormick school of interpretation of Barth, if you like, is that Van Til's read and interpretation of Barth was by no means a wild-eyed, inept, just incompetent interpretation. It was, I think that the recent scholarship has shown that Van Til was at the very least, and I would say more so than this, but at the very least, was a responsible, close, careful, and I would even go so far then as to say accurate, or at least potentially accurate, interpretation of Barth's theology.
Mm. Well, that's really helpful to know, and it is much to study, and it is important. First off, we understand better orthodoxy when it's put into conflict, and that's one important thing there. But also just the Christological concerns. We are always confronted with false Christologies. We get that in popular media, on television. We get that in popular books and all sorts of things, movies. We think of the Da Vinci Code and those sorts of things. And also understanding Barth in his context and understanding the underlying philosophical framework is a helpful exercise and practice for helping us to understand how so many errors in the church stem from incorrect frameworks, incorrect systems of thought. And so we always need to be reforming our mind, allowing the scriptures to renew us, as Romans 12 says. And we need to take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ, 2 Corinthians 10:5. And that is something Van Til was very intent on doing. And I think his work on Barth evidences that fact. So what can we read, Jim, for those various students of Reformed theology who would like to learn more about Neo-Orthodoxy? Of course, we've got the two books from Dr. Van Til, The New Modernism and Christianity and Barthianism. Where else might we go to learn about Barth?
Well, of course, you go to the Church Dogmatics. There's no substitute for actually reading the primary sources. Yeah, I would also say, you know, look up George Hunziker's book, How to Read Barth, and his collection of essays, Disruptive Grace. I think those are a good start. And then, you know, get into this debate between Hunziker and McCormick on Barth.
Actually, colleagues.
They think, Yeah, they're actually colleagues at Princeton, and they've got this, you know, debate going on in the academic literature, which is quite interesting. And it's interesting because not only will you pick up a lot of actual theology along the way, right? And you got to read sermons, but you'll also find out how to read and how to understand Bart a little bit better. But McCormick's has a couple of books out that are useful. His kind of primary text is Karl Barth's Critical Realistic Dialectical Theology. It's Genesis and Development, 1909 to 1936. It's an Oxford University Press book, and that is really his big one. And then his recent series of articles, Orthodox and Modern Studies in the Theology of Karl Barth, Baker 2009, is actually quite a good introduction to Barth's theology. So you could read that and then read the footnotes and then kind of
find out from there what else is out there. That's always helpful. I would encourage people to do that. If you don't already, read the footnotes and read the bibliographies, because they're really helpful tools at pointing you toward other scholarship. So I try to do that. I wish there were faster and better ways to do it electronically, but
One day there will be.
Well, Jim, thanks for chatting and visiting, and I really appreciate you coming on. This has been a fascinating subject, and hopefully people will find it fascinating as well. And I want to let people know you can visit Jim's church, if you don't already, at calvary-amwell.org, and there they have numerous sermons. You can hear Jim's preaching. Also, Jeff Waddington's out there. He preaches occasionally. He's the teacher of the congregation, and you know, check that out. And you're starting back with the radio ministry, is that correct?
Yeah, we will be broadcasting our sermons, not live, but
actually on radio, terrestrial radio.
On radio, mm-hmm. That's right, 9:20 a.m. out of Princeton.
Excellent. So that's exciting. I'm glad that you have that opportunity once again. So if you're in the area within Princeton, New Jersey, check that out on the AM radio. And you can visit Reformed Forum, of course, at reformedforum.org. And there you will find information about all of our programs, including the Reformed Media Review and Philosophy for Theologians, among others. And stay tuned to reformedforum.tv, where you can find out what we're doing live, where we're broadcasting and when and who's going to be up. There's a calendar on the website. So thank you so much for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.